Welcome to the Evolved Caveman, where men learn to be successful and happy with your host, Dr. John Schinnerer, as he shares the most impactful ideas and practices for you to get the most from your relationships, your work, and from your life. Now here's Dr. John.
Hey everybody, this is Dr. John back with the latest episode of the Evolved Caveman. And today I am really excited to have with me Pete Bucher, who is a retired orthopedic surgeon. And he left that nice plum job to become a meditation teacher and make lots of money and become a spiritual healer. Since 2012, he's been teaching mindfulness, meditation, stress relief, and how to heal the early life wounds that lead to stress, anxiety, depression, inflammation, and addiction. Having completed a PhD in mind-body medicine from good old Saybrook University in California, he's also the chief medical officer of Beha VR. I think I said that correct.
Behavior.
A digital health company providing root cause solutions to many of today's most challenging health conditions using comprehensive virtual reality experiences. And he lives in Louisville, Kentucky with his two amazing teenagers and a bevy of pets. Pete, thanks for coming aboard. How you doing?
Yeah, thanks for having me. I'm good.
So did I pronounce that correctly? Beha?
So it's a play on words. It's called behavior,
behavioral,
but it's spelled behavior, but with a VR because it's a virtual reality company. Yeah,
I did a company like that many years ago, trying to make a clever play on words, and I don't know. Like, I think I might have been too smart for the audience. So behavior.
Yes.
So tell me a little bit about your journey from hassle to happiness. I'm really curious about why you chose to leave orthopedics.
Yeah, it's not the usual path for sure. So for me, I guess it kind of goes back to, I always say, like, I've always had healer in my blood. I've always, and I think it goes back to a lot of my own childhood of growing up with divorced and very conflicted parents. They split when I was an infant, so I never had a home where my parents were in the same place at the same time in a happy way. And so I kind of grew up in that environment. And then, my dad was alcoholic. I later went through a period of being sexually abused for a few years by someone else. And it was a rough go in the early days. So I think they're just kind of that combination of things. I just always had this in my blood. Like I want other people to feel good, you know, like it's kind of the classic healer path, right? I'm so conflicted and torn. I want to help other people. And so I just sort of grew up with this in my head that for whatever reason, the way that made sense was become a doctor, be a doctor, like take care of people. And so that's all I ever wanted to do my whole life. I had about a 3 month period in college where I questioned it a little bit, but for the most part, that was all I ever wanted to do was to be a doctor. So I went that route and I got there and I loved it. I was happy in the work. I feel like I was pretty good at the work. I went through some personal upheaval. I went through a divorce and with two small kids and, questioning a lot of my own thought patterns, like what was going on in my life, like how did I get to here? I was a few years into medical practice at that point, maybe 5 years into medical practice at that point. And so I started kind of on my own. My house of cards came crashing down, I like to say. And I was sort of left with, okay, well, the only thing that connects all the parts of my life where I'm unhappy is me, right? Mm-hmm. That's the only connecting point. So I really started taking a hard look at myself and said, okay, I got to pick up my pieces and figure out who I am, where I'm going and what this life is about. At that point, I was, you know, approaching my mid late thirties. And so I was like, okay, it's time. And so, that translated into a path that has never stopped yielding in all that time. That was early 2009, so we're 12 years ago. It's just never stopped yielding. I started going to therapy. I found a therapist that was really good. He introduced me to meditation as part of my therapy. That was something that immediately felt like home. The second I started doing meditation, I was like, this is where I belong. Like this, this feels like home. I think that's the
first time I've heard that.
Yeah. Yeah. For, not to say, and, but the caveat there, John, is interesting because, we think of meditation as something that is peaceful or relaxing or makes us feel good. And honestly, the first 6 months to a year of doing meditation practice, it was anything but. I always say, like, I think all I was doing really was giving a safe place for all this pain, all this anger, all this grief, like from my those early childhood experiences to come up safely.
And can I ask you a question there?
Yeah.
Can I interrupt? Yeah. Because it seems to me that the training to be an orthopedic surgeon or to be a surgeon is, in a way, you have to divorce yourself from human emotion so that you can do a good job as a surgeon.
Yes.
And now you've stopped being a surgeon. Have you stopped being a surgeon at that point?
Yes. Not at that point. Mm-mm.
Okay.
Not at that point.
But then, so you're allowing this yourself room for, to reconnect with all those emotions. But at first, those emotions suck.
Yeah.
They're painful, right?
Very painful. Yeah. I probably in my meditation practice, that first 6 months to a year, I spent more time crying, being angry, feeling lost, like who am I? Like, how did I even get to here? There was a voice in my head that whole time that just said, but just stay with it. Like, this is what needs to happen. I knew that it was healing. I knew it sucked, but I also knew, like, this is what needs to happen. And I was doing it alongside.
Can I ask you another question there?
Yeah.
Pardon me for interrupting.
No.
So when you got divorced or separated, did you have the feeling or the thought, I'm a failure as a father, as a man, as a husband? Did any of that come up for you? It did for me. That's why I'm asking.
Yeah, a lot of shame. Just a lot of shame.
And I think that's important for other men to hear.
Yeah, and in all of its forms, shame. You know, starting with, I was blaming everybody else for my unhappiness.
Yeah.
You know, I was blaming my ex-wife.
That's what we do.
I was blaming her family. I was like, man, you know, the only people I never blamed for my unhappiness were my kids. I never, like, that was still the bright spot of my life forever. Still, you know, always. But everybody else, the job sucks, the marriage sucks, everything, right? And then that's when I had that harsh moment. And I remember very plainly looking at myself in the mirror one morning. I was getting for work, brushing my teeth or whatever, and I just kind of lifted up and caught myself in the mirror. And when I did, I this is not even an exaggeration. I literally caught my reflection in the mirror, and I was like, it was like looking in the face of a stranger. Like, I had no idea who I was anymore. And I just remember thinking, like, how did I get to here? Like, where have you gone? Like, what happened? And there was that moment, and I was like, okay, this is where it all has to change. This is where everything has to change. And so that's when I said, look, I'm going to get myself in physical shape. I'm going to start going to therapy. I'm going to get help wherever I can get it. Whatever it takes. Now, it took probably about 5 years or so of that journey, even from that point, to start looking down the barrel of sexual abuse and early life grief as a result of you know, growing up in a tumultuous, divorced, alcoholic home. A lot of codependence on my mother's side as well, and sort of smothering parenthood there. And they're wonderful people. My parents are wonderful people, but they're flawed. You know, they're flawed people. They had their own wounds. It just took a long time to kind of get to that point. But kind of getting back to your original question, as I was going through that process and learning meditation and about, you know, mindfulness practice and how transformative that became for me very quickly, I realized, because in orthopedics, you know, we think about taking care of, like, you know, the star athletes and the, you know, doing the joint replacements and that kind of stuff. But if you really boil orthopedics down, you really sit in an office and listen to people talk about pain all day long. That's it. People hurt. You don't go to your orthopedist to tell them how great you're feeling. The people who do really well sort of self-select out of your practice. They say, oh, great, you know, I'm doing better. Thanks, doc. And they're gone. And then, you know, so in listening to people's stories about their hurting, their inflammation, their chronic pain, like these injuries that nagged and nagged and nagged, or people that just never thrived after an injury or after a surgery or had real hard problems healing, I started seeing a common thread in their stories, right? There's a lot of underlying stuff there, a lot of underlying, at that time I would have said, you know, anxiety or stress or depression.
Depression, yeah.
Today I would probably boil most of it down to unhealed trauma. I mean, I think we all in some way, shape, or form carry unhealed trauma around, and we act like it's just normal. And it is normal, quote unquote, but it's not good, right? Like it's normal. Well,
can I pause you there, Pete?
Yeah.
I think that just for the listeners, there's a distinction between little trauma or little T and big trauma or big T. And I think most of us think of trauma as like, you know, I was held at gunpoint, or, you know, I saw my friend die by gun.
Yes.
But also keep in mind for listeners that little trauma affects us too. And that can be things like, I don't know, getting into a fight with a loved one, or getting kicked out of getting kicked out of the house. That could be big or little. But I like the idea that they're little drops of trauma or little drops of negative emotion that accumulate. And so, I like Faith Harper's definition of trauma as anything that disconnects us from a feeling of safety and security.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Truly. And for me, as we've talked about offline before, it really disconnected me from any sense of myself, of who I really am. I came to start to believe the stories about who I was supposed to be, as opposed to really exploring who I am. And so ultimately this journey came down to me figuring out who I am as a person, right? But as I started listening to the stories of the people I was seeing, I was going, no, there's so many bigger ways I can help these people. And honestly, feeling like my hands were tied, like this person has pain. There's nothing I can do with a pill, a procedure, or an injection, or whatever. There's nothing that's going to show up on an MRI. This person needs emotional release. This person needs, they need help in a different way. And so many people come to the doctor, even the orthopedic surgeon is about as black and white, cut and dry as you can get in the medical world. And so many people come, I was like, these people are just coming for connection. They're looking for validation. They're looking for something just to feel better in their own skin, right? And whether I can provide that or not. And so literally, even though I'd been through great medical training and I loved it, and I went to great places for my training, I really started feeling inadequate. Like there's something more I need to be doing here. And that's when I went I was doing all the stuff myself, going on retreats, going to meditation groups, went to the Jon Kabat-Zinn's professional training, the mindfulness-based stress reduction training, which is indirectly how I got here to you.
That's how you met Jory, which is how I met you.
Right.
Yep.
Literally, we sat right next to each other pretty much the whole week. But then I got back from that and I was just more determined than ever. Like, yes, this is a path that can help a lot of people in ways that we don't even understand yet. Right. And so I started looking for other things, which led me to that PhD program, and the rest is sort of history. But at some point in there, I felt, okay, there's gotta be more. And so I started teaching. I opened my own business to do that, which lasted a couple of years. Doing that alongside of a busy medical practice was ultimately just too much. But I just started finding more and more ways to do it. And then eventually what happened was, I became so, I guess so passionate about this other route of like, how do we get to root cause? How do we stop this at the beginning? How do we take people from the inflammation they have to the chronic stress that's causing it, to the underlying emotional dysregulation that's leading to the activation of the chronic stress, down to all the way to the base? Like, where do they become disconnected, right? Where's the trauma still active? And so that became my focus. And so at that point, once I was really heavy into that work, really, I left the operative world in at the end of 2016. I continued seeing some patients in the clinic. And at the end of 2019, I just said, no more, that my work is purely in this other area. It was after I left the surgical world that so about 3 months into that journey in March of 17, when I was introduced to Aaron Ganney, who's the CEO of Behavior, who was starting that company. And when we talked, it was like our visions were very aligned as to what we saw as the issue. Now, he came from the payer side. He was the chief technology officer of Humana. And, so he came from that side and saw a lot of the gaps that were existing there. And I was seeing the gaps from the clinical side, and then having this other experience, and we were sort of introduced by a mutual colleague, and we've been off and running ever since, and figuring out who we are as a company and where we fit and how we can really innovate to bring real solutions to people. But it was quite a journey, and it continues to be. I mean, I think, I guess like anybody, like when you go through this healing process and you start understanding things about yourself, you start looking around and you start to see it everywhere, right? Like I became so, mm-hmm. and I'm so hyper aware now, like, you know, you're in the grocery store and someone's being chippy with the checkout person. You go, yeah, that's just unhealed shit. Like they just need to,
yeah,
you know, and then that compassion comes, you start to love that person, whether before I'd have been like, man, what a jerk. But, and I could still have that thought, you know, but there's that underneath, there's that, it's like, man, I, you know, just somebody just needs to love this person, you know, and tell them it's okay. Like, so it's, yeah, it's been a really interesting path. So it's a really long answer to your question, but that kind of gets us to here. No, but that's,
it's a fascinating story because it's the only time I've heard that story of someone going to medical school and then leaving that behind because you saw, I think, you know, the trauma, the inflammation, the depression, the anxiety. And, you know, one of the thoughts that I've had recently is that, and I, you know, granted, I kind of focus more on men, so I'll take it in that direction, but it's true for all of us. I don't think any of us get through childhood or adolescence without some accumulation of little T. And even if you think of being teased or bullied or called names, all those add up. And I, one of the things that fascinates me, and we talked a little bit offline about core beliefs and how that can switch a core belief from something like the world is safe to the world's dangerous.
Yeah.
And just that one belief can impact everything that you do.
Everything. And an even deeper level is, what do I come to believe about myself? And even with trauma, even with going through, you know, sexual abuse, for instance, you know, what I sort of realized in myself was, you know, the abuse stopped decades ago. But it's like when you put your hand on a stove, if you don't then put your hand under ice or under cool water, the burn, the damage continues, right? So even though the abuse stopped, all of the patterns, the emotional patterns, the stories I would tell, so what I realized is what in every relationship is affected and all these things. And what I realized was, yeah, the abuse was bad and it was unjust and it was inexcusable. However, from the ages of 11 to 42, when I finally opened up and told somebody about it, it took me 30 years to tell anybody about it. When I finally opened up and told, or 40, I guess. Yeah. So I was about 40. So, before I opened up and told anybody about it, all that damage was still happening. I just couldn't see it yet. But what I realized was, yeah, the trauma is bad, but the part that caused the real damage throughout my life is what I came to believe about myself as a result of it. Mm-hmm. I came to believe that I was defective and that I was damaged and that I was the one at fault and that I should have shame about myself.
Yeah, I'm not worthy.
Which led me to believe even on a deeper level, like I'm not even lovable. Like I can't even be loved truly because of who I am. And when I was able to see that plainly and go, oh, well, that's just a story. Of course I'm lovable. We're all lovable. I mean, just the fact that I'm alive. And second of all, none of that was my fault. Like somebody else, you know, took advantage of, you know, a smaller, weaker person and manipulated me and set me up. And there was adults involved in that kind of grooming process and the whole deal. So it's kind of like, yeah, what chance did I really have? Mm-hmm. So I really started to be able to see it through my adult eyes and look back at my little kid self and sort of do this a little bit of kind of reparenting and say,
yeah,
now how can my adult self really kind of take care of this? And you just see it like, you know, it's just like this scared, sad little kid showing up in relationships with adult women and it doesn't work out well.
Did you see Rocket Man?
No, I did not.
At the end of Rocket Man, the movie about Elton John, there's this great scene where he's in group therapy for a 12-step program.
Yeah.
And at the end of the movie, all the characters from his life kind of come back in virtual form, imagined form. But one of them is his, I'd say, 6 or 7-year-old self.
Yeah.
And, you know, finally the little kid says, when are you going to give me a hug? And Elton John kneels down and gives him a hug and they both kind of cry. And to me, that's a beautiful image for people to think this is how you can reparent yourself.
Yeah, it is. It's amazing. And it's amazing. If you were outside, you know, walking by some playground and some little random kid ran up to you and said, you know, I don't think anybody could love me. You would be like, what are you talking about? Of course, like, you know, you're awesome. Like, look at you, you know, like, but we don't afford ourselves that same. It's amazing how blind we are to our own need for love, our own need for acceptance, our own need just to be validated.
Our own barriers to receiving that love.
Yeah. But you would do it in a heartbeat for somebody else.
Sure.
even a stranger.
But they're more worthy.
Yeah, exactly. So
that's how we think.
Yeah. So once I was able to see that, really look in the mirror and go, oh, you know, it's kind of like, and it's great because at that point the game is kind of up. Some of the old patterns will continue to show up, and you become much more aware of them and have, you know, agency to start to change things. But once I was able to see that, the game was really kind of up, and then I was like, okay, so now, you know, now you have the opportunity to make new choices, to behave in different ways, to not react the same old ways that you used to really realize that you are worthy, and that you are, you know, that you do deserve love just like anyone, and that you do have unique opportunities and talents. And yeah. And so once I was able to do that, it's kind of like there's been this journey over the last 7-8 years now of increasingly just feeling like I'm stepping into my own skin, which is the only place I've ever been anyway. So mm-hmm. It's like, so then you realize like, well, shit, I've only ever been able to be me. So the only thing blocking me from this has just been the way I've thought about myself. Yeah. It's the only barrier.
Well, and you were saying earlier when we talked offline about, and I really like this definition of trauma too, that the trauma isn't the event itself. It's the way that the event changes your narrative about yourself.
Yes, totally. Because when you're born, I mean, when you're born, you come into the world, you don't have any idea of who you are, that you have a name, a family, a sibling, some social order you're supposed to adapt yourself to. And even you talk about small T and big T, the big T stuff, almost like it's in your face. Like at some point you kind of have to look at it. The little T stuff is it's like a death by 1,000 pinpricks, right? Like
yeah.
you get told over and over again. Well, you know, the big one, of course, for guys, like, you know, oh, you know, toughen up. Don't be a sissy. Man boys up. Don't cry. Don't man up. You know, sack yeah. up, whatever. And, you know, we think of that as kind of like, oh, it's just being a dude. But really, it can be very harmful if that builds up over time, because you don't, mm-hmm. you know, we, like it took me, I was 40 years old. I'm sitting in my therapist's office. He said, what are you feeling right now? I said, I have no idea.
Yeah.
I have no idea what I'm feeling right now. He's like, well, are you sad? Are you angry? Are you scared? I'm like, I honestly, I have no idea.
Yeah. I can tell you what I think I feel. I should be sad.
I can tell you what I'm supposed to feel.
Yeah.
Like what, you know,
it's funny when I used to describe what I do, I would say something yeah. like, yeah, you know, I'll ask men, how do they feel? And the typical answer is, I don't know. And that's an honest answer. And yeah. and so we need to be taught, how do I even figure out what the hell I am feeling right now?
Yeah.
Because we're not, I mean, we get mocked and humiliated if we dare to go in that direction when we're younger.
Yeah. And it's,
so it's not safe.
Yeah, it's not safe. It's not safe to acknowledge that you're scared, to acknowledge that you're sad. It is safer for most men to act out in anger than pretty much anything else, which I know we've talked about, and you do a lot of work with anger. But, you know, we realize that we express anger as a way to avoid feelings or avoid expressions of other emotions of sadness or fear.
Avoid responsibility,
right? Externalize, like I was doing when I was getting divorced and everything, like everybody else is at fault. I'm just trying to be myself over here and all that bullshit I was telling myself at the time. But
yeah,
it's kind of sad. And hopefully as we have, you know, as we have these kind of conversations, as more men are kind of waking up to the fact that, yeah, this is toxic. And you mentioned 12 step. I mean, you sit in 12 step rooms enough, you hear enough stories where you go, yeah, this is really toxic shit that we think mm-hmm. of it as kind of like, you know, yeah, well, you know, this is what, how someone talked to me, or yeah, this happened to me when I was little, or yeah, kids bullied me when I was younger. And we sort of designed this whole life to sort of escape those feelings. But when you stop and you look at it, you go, God, that was really harsh. I remember there was a kid when I was in high school that got bullied pretty bad, and I wasn't involved in the bullying, but I beat myself up for a long time for not intervening. Like,
yeah,
what stopped me from just getting in the way and saying, look, don't stop, you know, like just even that is, even that stuff can kind of weigh on you. So there's so many things. And I think once we're able to just sort of be honest and open and talk about it, you know, you give it a space, and then you can let yourself off the hook a little bit. But yeah. like you said, when we carry it around and we hide from it and we react in different ways and we try to, it just builds up over time to where it becomes
too heavy. Well, and one of the patterns that I see is men that, you know, were bullied or had some physical defect early on, and then they spend the rest of their lives trying to prove themselves and or insulate themselves with wealth and or power.
Yes.
So that can never happen again, even though you could have all the money in the world and it doesn't really prevent you from being bullied or beaten up, which I think is kind of what we're trying to prevent.
Yeah. And a lot of it happens in our own minds. We're below
conscious awareness.
We're the ones that are beating ourselves up, or we're hearing other people's interpreting other people's actions. We're projecting that out on, you know, and receiving that back in. So it is kind of, it's a living hell. I always say, like, if you can't live comfortably in your own skin, it's a special type of hell to live in, because it's the only place you ever are.
Well, so let me ask you this. So you've done a lot of hard work and how comfortable are you in your own skin now? How happy are you? How content are you? Are you able to relax?
Yeah. Well, it's day by day, you know, most days. Yes. And I can honestly say that today I'm, in many ways, my life is much less certain than it's ever been. There's a lot more uncertainty in my life every day than there ever has been, because previously it was all about control and a path and goals and doing all these things. Today, it's I can live one day at a time and be okay with that and be okay with the uncertainty. I've never been more confident in myself. I've never felt like I'm able to speak up. And, you know, I had a situation even earlier today where I had to have an uncomfortable conversation with somebody because I felt like my toes had been stepped on. And that's not something I would have done, you know, 5-10 years ago. Mm-hmm. I would have stewed about it and brooded about it and done all the things and gone about it some passive aggressive way. But just to call the person and say, hey, look, I feel like you stepped on my toes here. Like, and I'm kind of pissed off right now. And then we talked through it and it was fine. So like, I feel much more, it's in a weird way, John, like I'm at a point in my life, I'm getting ready to turn 48 years old. And it's like, I'm just starting to feel like I'm really an adult. Like I'm able to like function on the level of what I think an adult male should function on, like in a healthy way. So, so the healing work pays off. But it's not easy. You know, there's a reason they call this stuff like the dark night of the soul. Like, it's hard. It's hard. You got to look at some painful shit. And those old feelings, like, because we shove them under the rug or we act like they're not there, it doesn't mean they're not there. And emotions, I'm firmly convinced, because I've experienced it, that all that emotional energy, that those emotions get stored. You know, they're stored in your body, literally. And when you get triggered in certain ways, they come out of nowhere. And it's they can hijack you.
Well, that's like that. You know, Basil Vandercook's whole, you know, his whole career, right? The body keeps the score. And at first I remember I was like, that's a crock of shit. And then the more I got into it, the more I was like, oh, wow. Yeah. This makes a lot of sense.
Yeah. I remember early on in this process when I was kind of going through some of the heavier pieces of that healing that we talked about. I remember at that time I was doing some pretty athletic stuff. I was doing some triathlons and that kind of stuff. And so I was getting regular massages, like every couple of weeks I was getting massages. And literally what I started experiencing was whenever she would work on a particular part of the body, certain thoughts, certain feelings, certain emotions would arise consistently. And I'm like, there's something to that. That's not coincidence. Stuff that had nothing to do with anything I was experiencing at the moment. It was like old stuff that was like coming out. I was like,
I remember Jory and I went to a Dan Millman retreat in Costa Rica, and they had these next level body workers. And this just blew me away. I was getting a massage to your point, but it was like this weird combination I'd never experienced before of massage and therapy all in one. And so she was massaging and she would hit some place and she would start asking me questions about my dad and my sons. And telling me that there was some intergenerational healing that needed to take place. Now, I guess on one level, that's a pretty safe bet for most men, but I was just like, I was so spun while having the massage. I'm like, yeah, she's right. Like, and it was kind of cool because being that relaxed allowed me to think about it, I think, at a deeper level.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And, you know, people that are really in tune, the body workers, a lot of times are very intuitive. So they'll pick up on some hits too, you know, and start asking those questions. But it's powerful. It's powerful stuff. My hope is, you know, that more men will feel comfortable to do this kind of stuff, to say, you know, enough.
And I think there's a wave coming. I feel that more and more men are open to this. And so let's go a little bit to that need for belonging that we talked about earlier offline, because I think, you know, for many men, there's an epidemic of loneliness going on, and we're disconnected, and we're not very good at keeping in touch with our old friends. And partly because I think we're worried they're going to be angry at us for not calling them for 5 years, but they didn't call us either.
Right.
So let's talk a little bit about that need for belonging, because I think that's a really important need.
It's a really important need. And we look at, like, why we get into, we become disconnected. So that's the difference between, of course, between men and women, is that, and again, not to overly stereotype or whatever, but just it's sort of a thing that you can observe, and it's documented with research.
It's a biological stress response.
Yeah, that women, as they go through stressors and tough times and difficulties, they lean into their friends. Whereas men, when we go through things, we pull away, we isolate. And
fight or flight, yeah.
Yeah, and so, and I think when I look at, so that need for belonging, that need for connection, it's almost like, what I see at the base of that, or what I experience at the base of that, and what I see in some of the people I work with, is a lot of times at the base of that is this intense complex of shame, right? Mm-hmm. It's this hiding because the feelings are uncomfortable. If I reach out and I have to talk about it, I'm going to look bad. My friends are going to think I'm a loser. I'm not going to be able, you know, I might put myself, my professional self in jeopardy. I might put my social self in jeopardy, whatever it might be. So again, we get back to that safety, right? We don't feel safe. And so,
well, in the because core, as a man, I think it's that you're worried about not being worthy of connection. That's kind of the deepest part of that
belief.
That's
it. I had friends I avoided after my divorce. I had friends I avoided because I'm like,
they're going to judge me.
They're going to judge me. They're going to think I'm this, that, or the other. And, you know, and then after a few years, I sat down with a couple of them, like, you know, I've been feeling this way. They're like, what? That's crazy. Like, you know, I wanted to be there for you, but I didn't want to get in your business, you know? And I was like, we start to realize, like, it doesn't have to be that way. And again, we get in the story, but for me in my life, when I hide, it's because I feel shame. I feel scared. I feel unworthy of that connection.
Well, but one of the other things that's come to mind recently since we last talked is I've seen some college students, male college students, who are willing to do a lot of behaviors in order to belong, I believe. And think of drinking, smoking, doing mushrooms, cocaine, whatever drugs are around, or sleeping with women because everyone else in the fraternity house is sleeping with women, and I don't want to appear different, so I'm going to do the same. I want to belong. Yes. And I think it's fascinating to me the lengths that we'll go to prove our worthiness to belong to the group.
Yeah, and I look at that and I say, okay, so why, right? So this is a question I ask that gets me in a lot of trouble, but also leads to a lot of insight, right? Just keep asking why. So why do we do that? Why do we care? Why do we involve ourselves in behaviors that are uncomfortable to us in order to fit or belong, right? And we say, well, they'll make fun of me if I don't. Okay, well, let's go deeper. So why does that matter? Well, if they make fun of me, then I'll be, you know, kicked out of the group, or I won't, whatever.
Or embarrassed.
And then you keep going. Well, as you keep going down that pathway, ultimately it comes to this deep primal fear, I think, that we have just biologically of abandonment, of being...
Well, it's getting kicked out of the tribe, right? And really, it does speak to our survival need, because if we get kicked out of the tribe in the old days, we're dead, pretty much, or you know, really hard to survive.
That's it. And if you're a kid, you know, when you're a little kid, these patterns get imprinted when you're very, very young. And when you're a little kid, you know, 3, 4, 5 years of age, for most of us, is where this stuff really gets cemented. If you're 3, 4, 5 years of age and your parents abandon you, that in your reptile brain, like, I'm not going to make it. I'm not going to survive, right? So that's the deepest fear. Once you're through that, once you realize, like, again, in my adult life, I kind of explored that, right, through the meditation, through the therapy, through just me being deeply introspective all the time, sometimes to a fault. I realized that abandonment fear and how terrifying it felt. Like, literally, I was going to fall into the abyss without a net. Like, I was just going to fall forever. And then I realized how silly that is. Like, I'm like, well, look, I'm a 40-something-year-old man. I have a good job. I'm parenting 2 kids pretty well. They're good kids, and they got good heads in the shoulders, and I'm making it in life. There's really no abandonment that can happen to me at this point. Like, I'm fine.
But we can react to that fear of abandonment in relationships too. So if you take it from the frat house, and for those of you who are offended by the word frat, because, you know, we don't call our country a, right. But I don't really give a shit about that. I think that if you go from the frat house to relationship, I mean, I've seen it in myself where there are times when I get shamed or I feel ashamed. I wasn't shamed. And I feel I'm unworthy of connection. And so I withdraw.
Yes. Yes, absolutely. Yeah, I think it's such a big deal. So I look at it. I look at the base thing for most of us as some sense of shame. And when I say shame, I don't mean just like feeling embarrassed or guilty about something. The best definition that I've heard, and I sort of use this, and I apologize, I can't remember who I heard say it, so I don't want to claim a quote that isn't mine. But I literally can't remember who said it. But it's like, think of it this way. You know, guilt is feeling like I've done something wrong. Shame is like feeling I am something wrong.
Right.
It's cellular. It's like it's in your bones. It's in your DNA. Like there is something wrong with me. I am defective. And if anybody finds out, I'm exposed. I'm a fraud. Right. We feel like an imposter.
One of the things that's fascinating to me is I can find a purpose for every emotion under the sun. I can't find a purpose for shame. Like no. I just don't see, because I think shame is always lying to us, because shame is causing me to believe that I'm unworthy of connection, which is absolute crap. All of us are worthy of connection. All 7.3 billion.
I see it as kind of the opposite. It's kind of the opposite force of that abandonment fear, right? The shame is like, it's the thing that keeps us in orbit. Because if I feel like there's something wrong with me, I feel like there's something I need to be doing to be better, to fit better, to somehow make my way into this tribe, into this family, and therefore I can get my needs met and I can continue to have shelter and connection and all these things we're talking about. But the problem is it survives into some place. It survives into some place where it no longer belongs. Like we carry this stuff, right? We carry this stuff. We learn to fit into our social structures and everything when we're young. And then we carry that into adulthood and we develop all these coping mechanisms and all these reactions and all these things that we do, these tendencies, personality tendencies and relationship attachment styles, all this stuff. And then we carry it into adulthood where it no longer works. And so now, you know, I have, fortunately for me, one divorce. I have friends who have been divorced 2, 3, 4 times because like the same patterns keep showing up. Right.
Yeah.
So at some point you just stop and you go, uncle, like, what do I got to do? Right. And then you realize, oh, these are all coping mechanisms, which no longer work because they're based on a story I told myself when I was 3. Like they don't work when I'm in my 40s anymore. So we then have to kind of look at it and go, okay, well, we start dissecting that apart, and then you can break into that shame complex, so to speak, and start disintegrating it by realizing the belief that it's set up on, like whether it's an not worthiness belief, very common for men, like I'm not worthy as I am. I need to be stronger. I need to be tougher. I need to make more money. I need to have a better car. I need to, you know, sleep with more women or whatever it is. Right?
I need to be bigger than a baby's arm.
Yeah, that's right. Bigger than so it's
you're laughing. I'm not laughing.
Yeah. There you go.
No, sorry, is it just me? I don't know. Maybe it's just me.
It's just you. You're the only one concerned with that.
Damn, I feel so much shame.
I know, right? But that's it. Like, and we have all these beliefs that we set up to offset those feelings of inadequacy, right? Of because we have to. You know, I think evolutionarily you have to fit, you know, you want to be the one that's picked to, you know, for whatever, for mating or to be a part of the community or whatever.
Yeah. So, the cutest girl.
Yeah. Whatever it is. And so we have all these stories we tell ourselves about how I need to be better than I am. And really you can only ever be exactly who you are at the exact time that you are that, like there's nothing else you could be. Yeah. So we're in constantly running from ourselves. Let's say it's like being on a hamster wheel. You just never get off of, or a treadmill to nowhere. Like you just keep running and you realize, what am I running toward? Like there's nowhere to get. Or what am I running from? Right. There's nothing to be scared of at this point. Like everything I'm afraid of is somewhere in my past, which doesn't exist anymore. Like it's wild how the mind constructs these worlds.
It generates stories
that fantasies we live in. And, I never really understood that in the meditation and spiritual world when they talked about, you know, deconstructing the story and the ego and the true self and all these things. And then over time you realize, oh yeah, this is an illusion. Like you literally are living in a mirage that you can literally step out of
your own making.
Of your own making. Yeah. That we build the machinery for to keep it going.
Well, hey, Pete, so this part of the conversation has been fascinating, and I'm also aware of time, and I want to talk a little bit about your new company this virtual reality and mental health, because that part is fascinating as well.
Sure. Yeah. So based on all the personal experiences I've shared and doing the PhD program, where I was really interested in like the role of chronic stress and health and inflammation and pain and anxiety, depression, all the things we talked about, that I was seeing in the clinical world. And I got really interested because I knew that, okay, yeah, this problem is much bigger, A, than we're doing anything about in the health world today. B, much bigger than we have the resources or personnel to deal with it. We already know, mm-hmm. I mean, you're a mental health professional, you know, like that system is just, it's just slammed. And you can't just suddenly train a bunch more people, like suddenly just certify a bunch more people to take care of the need.
Especially since COVID, it's going to be a tsunami of depression and anxiety coming up.
Yeah, there already is. Like the rates of reported are already up 3 to 4x because
domestic violence is up. I mean, there's some problems violence, headed our way.
Violent crime, all of it. So I was like, okay, so we have this. I just sort of saw it. Like there's going to be, once people start really becoming aware of this, like the system is not prepared. So how do we deal with that? Well, the easiest way to deal with that, the short story, is digital, because you can scale technology, and you can scale technology if it's done in a thoughtful and appropriate way. We can't scale humans so easily. So I just got really fascinated. And at the time when I was doing that early part of my PhD work, I was interested in web-based, you know, stuff, because that was kind of the cutting edge. Well, now, of course, everything is moving so fast. So by the time I actually got to doing something professional with it, I was introduced to I mentioned Aaron, and he had this company, and I had no experience with VR at all. And I went to meet him that day and told him my background and what I was interested in. He told me his background, what he was interested in. I was like, this sounds awesome. And he's like, if you're done VR, I was like, no. He's like, well, you need to do that before you decide to come on board. So the guys, at that point, there were two other employees in the company. You know, they put me in a headset and showed me some experiences. And I was like, based on what I wanted to do and based on what I saw in this technology, I was like, this is it. This is how we do it. Like, this is
I think it's brilliant, because just putting the headset on and running through some experiences can automatically trigger the same physiological responses as any emotion, pretty much.
Yes, you can.
And then you can work on reducing like the heart rate, the muscle tension, all the physiological symptoms.
All of it.
In a safe environment.
That's right. And you build self-awareness. And even with skill building, like even with something like mindfulness, which is so hard to teach to somebody, even when they're receptive to it, right? There's a real ethereal kind of experience. It's not something you say, okay, well, we get your heart rate to here, then you're going to be in a state of mindfulness, right? It's like, it's a very intangible thing for a lot of people.
Right.
But in VR, you have the capacity to change people's state and to actually help induce those states of the experience of mindfulness, for instance, so that they go, oh, that's what that is. And then they know. Then when they go outside in the VR and they go out in the real world and they're doing mindfulness stuff, they understand what it is they're experiencing. So the VR, the short story on VR is we can change someone's state almost instantly, because you hijack literally their input system into all of the primitive parts of the brain, the limbic system, all of it. And then we can teach, like you said, we can trigger them and then teach them to self-regulate in the moment through the experience. And we can even monitor what they're doing using biometrics, using things like heart rate.
I like what you said earlier.
Yeah.
In the sense of, I think it's important to teach people simply how to relax first, to turn on the relaxation response, that parasympathetic nervous system, because so many of the men I deal with are so disconnected from that. They think that when they're relaxed, they're tired.
Yes.
And so if you don't have a physiological goal to return to, a baseline, where are you going? You know, when you get, when you have a panic attack or anxious or depressed. So you've also, sorry, I took you off track. There's so many ways to go with this. But also run us through like some of the scenarios look like. So we were talking about scenarios for, I think, social anxiety, and I thought that was pretty fascinating.
Yeah. So imagine that you are someone who identifies you may not, you know, a lot of guys probably don't say, oh, I think I have social anxiety. statistics on that, there's, you know, it's more prevalent in women. That's because I think women are more self-aware about it.
Right.
Or will admit men are like, oh, it's fine. I get all nervous when I speak in public or whatever.
It just makes me angry.
This makes me angry. Or, yeah, I don't want to go to that. I don't want to go meet with all these strange people I don't know. I'm going to, you know. But really, we start looking at it and we go, yeah, this is, you know, I'm just unable to really, like for me, if I'm going to an event where there's a bunch of people I don't know and I'm going to have to walk into a room full of strangers, I mean, I get very anxious. I've done that before myself. I'm awkward as hell when I'm talking to new people, but I go, yeah, now I just kind of embrace it and then work through it and then we're fine in 2 minutes. But before it was paralyzing. And so you just imagine that, you have people who are really hindered. Like they can't go on, they won't go on dates because they don't want to be at dinner with someone they don't know and afraid of the judgment or the
embarrassment
might come. Yeah. If you say the wrong thing or you wind up with a piece of salad in your teeth or whatever. And so what we do is we take people who right now who self-identify as being socially anxious. And then we can put them into scenarios in a safe way. We teach them a little bit of self-regulation, a little bit of mindfulness, a little bit of deep breathing, like you said, a little parasympathetic activation. So pulling them out of the stress response. And then we put them into social experiences, like talking to a stranger, getting a drink from a bartender. Oh, you knocked your drink over. Now what are you going to do? Right. Like the person who's going to give the toast forgot. Can you read this toast to everybody? Like putting people in scenarios that are anxiety provoking. But in ways, the nice thing with VR is that we can do that in a very dose-controlled way. So someone's getting really aroused, and we're sensing that through the biometrics, like through the heart rate monitoring. While this person is really aroused, we can stop the exposure. We can bring them back down. We can talk them through it and then bring them back in a gentle way. So we can control the dose, the intensity of the exposure. But then what we do is once they do the exposure, then we take them into a whole thing where they can identify the thoughts they were having, and they can learn, you know, well, here's another way you could think about this. And we give them some challenges that way and then allow them to do some, you know, to come down with some relaxation and really.
Yeah, I like the one we were talking about going
circuits,
to,
right?
Being at a wedding, right? Where you have to talk to people at your table and you don't know any of them, or introduce yourself, or go up to the bar and get a drink, or oops, you spilled your drink on someone. Now what do you say? And so they're gradually increased levels of anxious situations.
Yeah. So the nice thing is that you can do dose controlled. I guess the short story is you can control the situation, which you can do much easier than you can do in real life. Even if you're a very good exposure therapist, you know, when you take someone out into the wild, so to speak, there's only so much control you have. Right. Somebody has a terrifying phobia of spiders. You can put them in a room with a spider. You can't control what the spider is going to do, right? So, or how many other ones might crawl out of the woodwork. So in this case, we don't do that type of exposure at this point, but you then could very much control. If they were getting really terrified, you could make the spider walk away, but it's still in the same room. Or it's much smaller now, right? We can control the dose and the intensity, so to speak, of the exposure. So that's really one of the strong things about VR is that you can convince yourself, you can know cognitively that none of this is real.
Yep.
But your body will react in the same way it does in real life, because it's going through that what's called the bottom up approach. It's coming up through the thalamus and the limbic system and then up to the cortex, as opposed to you sort of imagining it or kind of cognitively trying to think through it. So that's one of the beautiful things about the VR. Other things we do, it's all sort of based on this idea of mitigating the chronic the stress response, of building emotional resilience in the moment, awareness, self-awareness, awareness of emotions, the ability to regulate, and then being able to get into real life situations and then utilize those skills, and even being triggered to being cued, so to speak, to use your new skills to de-escalate the situation.
So one of the questions that listeners might have is, when can I get this? So you were saying that it's not quite available for the consumer, correct?
Yeah. So the distribution channels are interesting because it's a new technology. It's, you know, it's not as expensive as it used to be, but it's not cheap. It's, you know, you can't just download an app on your smartphone and start looking at it. Like you have to have a headset and, that kind of thing. So we have a number of different experiences in the market. Some of them come top down through provider and provider networks. We're working with some health insurance, you know, avenues to try to get distribution within, like if you belong to a certain health network, then it could be distributed to you that way. But we are working on a direct-to-consumer version, so stay tuned. As the technology is shifting here in the next few months, we'll have some. I'm not sort of fully at liberty to say just yet, but we'll have some opportunities in the direct-to-consumer.
Fantastic. Well, thanks so much for taking the time to have this conversation. This has been an awesome, awesome conversation. And is it okay if I put your email out there for people that want to contact
you? Yes, absolutely. I gave you the email, pete@petebuecher, and the spelling is a little funny, but it's B-U-E-C-K-E-R, pete@petebuecher.com. You can find me on Instagram and Twitter at The Peaceful Bull. Yeah, I guess that's about it.
All right. Well, thank you again. I really
answer questions or help any way I can.
Really appreciate your time.
Yeah. Thanks for having me.
And that's it for this episode of The Evolved Caveman. Please be sure to like, share, and review to get the word out.
Thank you for listening to the Evolved Caveman podcast. If you like what you've heard, support us by subscribing, leaving reviews, and sharing the podcast with friends and colleagues. For the latest, most powerful tools to connect with like-minded men, join the Facebook group at The Evolved Caveman. Follow Dr. John on Instagram at The Evolved Caveman, all one word, or join the email list by visiting guidetoself.com.